Good afternoon. It is 12:02, and it's a Friday. You know what that means. That means it's our special guest, New Hampshire Senator Jeb Bradley. Senator, thank you very much for being on the air with us today.
Thank you.
Not a problem. Did you know, by the way, that you were the most prolific bill sponsor so far this session?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you know. I didn't know if you kept track of those things, but yeah, 64 bills.
Well, let me just say something about that.
Sure.
I think with the exception of my broadband initiative, which is something, you know, that I came up with the idea that it would be a good idea, I think virtually every other bill I've been asked to sponsor by sometimes constituents. I've sponsored some for the governor. You know, so generally speaking, I have sponsored bills that people have brought to me. So that just, I guess, by virtue of the fact that I'm the majority leader in the Senate, that happens.
Yeah, I guess. I guess it's always nice to have the stamp of approval of the boss, I guess, being the majority leader. But still...
Well, I don't know that it helps if the... at the end of the day, get anything passed, you know, by virtue of the fact that I sponsored it. But I think it, you know, unless it's something I really have a problem with, I do feel that, you know, people, the public, have to have access to the legislature, especially now. And if people bring an idea that, you know, as long as I don't have a major problem with it, I just out of courtesy generally will sponsor it. That being said, I have turned down quite a few things this year just because of the fact that we're doing everything remotely and it is more difficult to, you know, get things through the process. So I've urged some people that I didn't think things were pressing in terms of timeliness, or they came in late in the process, to hold off until next year.
Okay. 12:05 this afternoon, and we're talking with Jeb Bradley, of course, Wolfsboro resident, New Hampshire senator. A beautiful day on tap tomorrow. You're going to be out on the hills?
Haven't decided yet. I find that hiking in April and early May, too, can be some of the harder hiking. The trail conditions are so variable. You know, starting at the base of the mountain, generally it's bare at this point up to about 3,000 feet. But then, you know, do you need the spikes to deal with ice? Do you need snowshoes if there's still, you know, deep snow? It can be, you know, there's places still in the mountains where they're 2 or 3 feet of snow, and how warm is it? If it's warm, then you need snowshoes. And after a while, you just get sick of carrying snowshoes. And so I got a lot of work to do in the garden. So I'm sort of weighing, you know, do I want to go out tomorrow? It's going to be a gorgeous day and carry snowshoes that the last two times I've hiked, you know, you add an extra 5 pounds and you don't really need them. They stay on your pack the whole day. Or would I rather work in the garden, which needs a lot of work? So that's what I'm going to be thinking about tonight.
Well, I guess there are worse things you can think about. I don't know if talked to you about it. Have you seen Northwood's Law on television?
I have not.
Oh, my! That's the show that follows around New Hampshire conservation officers.
Oh, yeah.
It's hilarious.
I've heard of that, actually. I've heard of it.
I hadn't until just a couple of weeks ago and happened to tune in, and it's like, oh, yeah, I just drove by there the other day. And it's amazing how, you know, those of us who aren't big hunters and fishermen, you know, rarely have opportunity to talk with fish and game. And it's amazing the stuff that they do.
Well, these guys and gals are really spectacular, you know, what they do, protecting, you know, New Hampshire's natural resources, but they're also, you know, out in all kinds of different weather and conditions, pulling people out of the woods.
Yep.
That, you know, I have found that over the last 10 years, the popularity of hiking has increased dramatically. And that's a great thing. It's healthy. It brings people to New Hampshire. We have lovely, you know, scenery and mountains and everything like that here in the state. But even though our mountains aren't all that high, they're very rugged, and preparation is really important because things can, you know, go south pretty quickly. And I just have seen, you know, more people percentage-wise just unprepared. And I climbed Lincoln and Lafayette, I think it was 2 weeks ago, on Saturday, April 10th. And it was a pretty nice day. It was fairly warm. It was probably in the low 50s on the ridge between Lincoln and Lafayette, the Franconia Ridge. And no snow because it's above tree line. It melts pretty quickly. But in the woods, there was still 3 feet or more of snow in places. And it was cool enough in the woods that I actually didn't need snowshoes, but I carried them. I think I was the only person I saw all day, and there were, you know, at least a couple of hundred people that had snowshoes. I'd say half the people had spikes, which I was carrying and wearing when it was snowy. But then, you know, I saw people in blue jeans. I saw people in shorts and sneakers and no spikes. And I'm just thinking to myself, boy, things go, you know, south here for anybody. You know, Fish and Game is going to be called up the hill to drag people out. Thankfully, everybody that day made it out. I didn't read of any rescues, but that was the area where there was a real notable rescue. I think it was in February, of a couple of people that were trail runners. And the whole point of trail running is you're up and down pretty quickly, so people don't carry much gear, maybe a little water, a little food, and a windbreaker, which, you know, in June, July, August, September time frame is okay. It's not recommended, but, you know, people do it, and it's generally going to be okay. But in February, not a good idea. And so they probably didn't check the weather. The weather was kind of foggy. They got off trail, which is pretty easy to do coming down Lafayette if you don't know the trail, because it sort of zigs and zags. And if you're not paying attention, you get off trail, and then the next thing you know is like, oh, where am I? And you're on different kind of snow. Like when you're on the trail, because there have been people before you, it generally is packed down. There are markers. You're not, you know, going to post hole on the top of a tree. But you get off trail, and the snow is softer. And so what happened apparently is, you know, one of the hikers, you know, sunk into a probably a tree where it's a little warmer, the snow is a little softer, and you can sink down 4 or 5 feet really quickly. Lost his shoes and couldn't get them. And so they took off down the mountain barefoot, this one hiker did, until they couldn't go any further. Thankfully, they still had enough juice in their cell phone to call for a rescue, and a chopper was able to get up there and get them about 15 minutes before the mountain totally fogged in and it would have been too dangerous to rescue. And, you know, they were really badly hypothermic, and it, you know, could have been deadly. So that's what Fish and Game, you know, does. And they do a really good job of you know, rescuing people. It's a tough situation.
Yeah,
but
I gotta,
that's where preparation is really important.
I got to confess, you know, when I first started watching the show, I'm like, all right, you know, you're giving this guy crap over not having a fishing license. But then I realized, you know, we only have so many things here in New Hampshire, and someone's got to take care of them, and that's what Fish and Game does, to make sure that there will be fish for the next generation and all of these things. So, you can't ride your ATV on a trail at 50 miles an hour. You're going to hurt somebody or yourself. And like I said, not being a hunting or a fisherman, this was all new to me. But it's a fascinating show. If you haven't seen it, it's on Animal Planet, and it's called Northwoods Law. Cool show. All right. One of the things I wanted to talk to you a little bit about today was constituent service. It's very common to, when you're having either a strong opinion on a bill, or maybe you need help, you're caught in some bureaucratic red tape, people come to you with that?
Yes, all the time.
Right.
And I would encourage your listeners, if there's a situation like that, reach out to me. The easiest way to get me is on my cell phone, which I think I've said several times on your show, but I will again.
Mm-hmm.
603-387-2365. And, I can't promise to be able to resolve every issue, but, if an issue is resolvable, we'll generally speaking be able to get to the bottom of it. And oftentimes it's just pointing people, to the right department. And sometimes it's helpful to have, myself or my assistant making the calls to the department, because, voicemail systems that just are difficult for the public. I totally get that, because, if I have to call my credit card company or something like that, I can be on hold for quite a while too. So we're happy to, we're happy to do that, and that's a big part of the job.
How much time do you spend doing that in a week?
It varies. I don't always do it myself. I have a, really capable assistant who, generally speaking, I'll try to point her in the right direction. Sometimes, I do pick up the phone myself. It just depends on the, on the situation. Sometimes, people reach out to me quite a bit about, I just had someone reach out to me about not receiving a stimulus check that they should have gotten, and where was it? So, I sent that person a email with, the number of, an outreach person in Congressman Pappas's office, because that's a federal issue. So it just depends. And, several hours a week, probably, all told.
Why do you think it's easier for you to cut through the red tape than for me to do it, for instance? Is it because you have state senator, in front of your name?
Yeah, that helps. And I also have, people's, cell phones too, oftentimes. Or, when Ava, my assistant, emails a commissioner and says, Senator Bradley, would like to talk to you about A, B, or C, that generally gets, their attention a little bit quicker. I mean, it is what it is. I'm not saying it's right, but there are only 24 hours in the day. And I think, our state employees, especially during COVID, have been working really hard to try to solve people's problems. And, it's helpful if somebody has an issue. I mean, there were hundreds of people that, because the unemployment rules, for instance, changed during COVID, you could be self-employed and collect unemployment. So there were a lot of people that weren't getting timely responses, or didn't fill out one of the boxes correctly, or any number of things, because so much of it was online. And my guess is we probably helped 200-300 people at a minimum get their unemployment, which they were entitled to, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was a big part of what we're supposed to do.
Has the federal unemployment supplement kicked in yet?
So it hasn't really gone away. And I can't remember exactly what the newest one is under the...
I think it's 300.
I thought it was a little more. It had been 600 right after the pandemic hit. It was $600
right.
a week.
I remember that.
That first CARES money. Then it was reduced to 300. And I thought it kicked back up to something between 300 and 600. I probably should know, but I don't. So that's on top of the New Hampshire unemployment, which ranges from $185 to $425, depending on what your income level was prior. So you add, you know, the several hundred dollars on top of that, and it, quite frankly, was meant to, you know, help people that, I mean, it could have been, you couldn't go back to work because your kids weren't in school, or you couldn't go back to work because you might have had a health condition yourself, or you were taking care of a elderly parent and you were very concerned about, you know, potentially infecting that person that resided in your house. So there are a lot of reasons why, you know, people, you know, weren't able to go back to work. So it was meant to, just as the PPP loans were meant to help keep businesses afloat, the unemployment was helped to keep families afloat. Now, at this point, as more and more people are getting vaccinated, and hopefully we are, you know, I don't think the pandemic is going to end, but I think our ability to manage it is increasing every day with the vaccines and now warmer weather and things like that. You know, the governor is requiring people to actually go back to work, which I think is appropriate at this point because there are thousands of jobs that are going begging as, you know, the economy in New Hampshire is starting to take off again. And so I think he's on the right track there.
Isn't 3% roughly our unemployment rate a little too low? Because, as you say, thousands of jobs are going begging. Or some
I don't think
like...
any unemployment rate is too low, personally.
Okay.
I mean, you always want it as low as possible. That being said, we were, before the pandemic, down around 2.5%, which was virtually full, you know, employment.
Mm-hmm.
With the pandemic, it obviously went skyrocketed, and now we're down to 3%, which is one of the lowest, again, in the country, and that's a great thing. That being said, it's hard to get people in many different jobs right now, and employers have, you know, pretty dramatically increased, you know, the pay scale to get people, you know, to come back into work. So it's a good time, if you're looking for a job, to find a job. But, you know, I always want to see as many people employed as possible. I think that there are two ways to look at unemployment. There's the unemployed in the so-called workforce. Okay, that's how we judge or we quantify unemployment in this country. So it's based on the workforce. But then the broader issue is, what's the workforce participation? And a lot of people, not just in New Hampshire, but throughout the country, have dropped out of the workforce because of whatever reason. There are a lot of different reasons. And our workforce participation rate in the, you know, the last few years had ticked back up somewhat, and it's dropped again. So the incentives to get people back to work, actually, you know, with pay scale, have increased, you know, prior to the pandemic, the workforce participation rate. And that's a good thing, I think, whether it's, you know, seniors that, you know, are working part-time or possibly even full-time, even while they're on Social Security, or younger workers, or, you know, what have you. I think, you know, having a greater workforce participation is a good thing.
Do we have, pardon me, do we have a person shortage or a skilled person shortage?
So I think if you talk to big employers, Eric, around the country, it would be some of both. So, you know, that's why employers have been open to, you know, increasing levels of immigration. But you also have to remember, with increasing levels of immigration, you're going to have a bigger work pool that is going to depress wages, because you'll have more people competing for those jobs. Right now, you know, jobs are going unfilled, but, you know, presumably as we work our way out of the pandemic and more people come back into the workforce, as schools are open, as we're less worried about, you know, some of those other healthcare concerns I talked about before. So, you know, the hundreds of thousands, which will turn into, you know, well over a million people crossing the southern border, that's only going to depress wages for, especially for people, you know, that don't have the same skill level that, you know, high-skilled workers would have, for instance. So I think, you know, a reason that we really ought to insist upon border security, just to protect the earning power of, you know, people in this country.
Sure. It just seems that there are an awful lot of skilled labor jobs, like manufacturing, CNC, that kind of thing. It's very strange how those jobs don't seem to get filled. They pay very well.
They pay well. I mean, we have a dramatic shortage of healthcare workers in New Hampshire.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, that's a big problem. And those are good-paying jobs. Even, you know, the starting salary of a nursing assistant, an LNA, and the ability for nurses to, you know, sort of move up to being certified and then being registered, you know, we need many more of those individuals. And, you know, there's some licensure issues that we're trying to streamline. There are some supervision issues that we're trying to streamline. There's also reimbursement rates for Medicaid that, you know, need to be enhanced. We did it 2 years ago in the budget, but it probably is going to need, you know, at least in certain segments, you know, for instance, I had a conversation earlier this week with folks about healthcare workers that, you know, go into people's homes, senior citizens' homes, to provide them the services that they need to keep them out of nursing homes. And more people obviously want to stay out of nursing homes. It's a better quality of life, but they need, you know, maybe it's shopping for groceries, maybe it's bathing, maybe it's, you know, just are you taking your medicines, basic, you know, type of services, home making services, that kind of thing. And, you know, it costs about $20,000 a year to provide that kind of service to a senior, and it's over $50,000 for a nursing home cost. So it, you know, it doesn't pay to, you know, not fund these services. So that's, you know, and the reason that the services are going begging is because they can't hire enough people, because the pay scale isn't, they're not able to compete with, you know, a lot of other entities that are hiring people at higher wages. So, you know, these are budget problems that we need to deal with.
Long as we're on budget problems, I remember, I believe it was last year, there was something called the Main Street Relief Fund. Is that still operating, or do you have any idea on how much that was able to help?
So that provided a lot of help for businesses, you know, that it was a, what happened is Governor Sununu took some of the CARES money and created a state-based relief program for businesses, a lot of whom had fallen through the cracks on the payroll protection. That money has been largely utilized, to the best of my knowledge. That was the whole design of it, to try to keep businesses afloat. I think it was pretty successful. What may happen with, you know, some of the new money that is coming in from the stimulus plan? You know, would we need to utilize some of that to keep some businesses afloat? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think that we're going to have to see how the hospitality industry does this summer. I mean, that clearly is the one area of, you know, the business world in New Hampshire that has been hit, you know, the hardest. And, you know, are people ready, willing, and able to go back and eat in restaurants now that they're getting vaccinated? And that's still an open question. So would we utilize some of those dollars for that? That is a possibility. I think, you know, another thing that, you know, we're hoping to utilize some of those dollars for are infrastructure type projects like water grants, more money for road and bridge repair, my broadband bill. That's how we're going to fund that. So these are all things that the Senate is dealing with as we're trying to put together our budget.
So you guys have been fairly busy.
Yep, we are.
When is the next session?
So far, I've still been able to do this Friday afternoon interview, though.
And I appreciate that. When is the next session?
So we've been meeting every week. Mm-hmm. We met yesterday. Everything is remote still. We have been meeting pretty much every week since February. We took 1 week off in February, and then 2 weeks ago we did not have session either. And that primarily was to allow committees to have extra time to conduct public hearings, because we got a slew of House bills from their one session, I think it was in early April, and so we're trying to process all those bills. So our sessions have been, generally speaking, you know, have worked. I think in mid-May is likely to be the first time that we're back in the State House. We've had some meetings. The Finance Committee is meeting in the State House, taking, you know, still appropriate cautions. But, you know, we spent a lot of money on HEPA filters that change over the air in a room like every 10 or 12 minutes. Pretty soon we're going to be able to open the windows. And that, you know, is obviously pretty helpful too. So
it is 12:30, and we're talking with Jeb Bradley, of course, our state senator and New Hampshire Senate Majority Leader. Couple of bills that have been floating around I wanted to talk to you about, if that's okay.
Yep.
First one was Senate Bill 123 about employer payment of COVID tests. Now, I always thought that all of these tests were paid for by the CARES Act money. Is that not the case?
The reason we passed that is because if there are, you know, any instances where a business is requiring a test, they should be paying for it. There was no opposition to it.
Yeah, I noticed all of these passed, the Senate bills passed 23-1, which was kind of impressive. I'm curious who the one is, but I don't really want you to tell me.
Well, I'd have to go back and look,
yeah,
because oftentimes it's a different person.
I just wonder what that one person had, you know, what his reason was. But
who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
I sometimes wonder that myself.
One of the bills you did sponsor, Senate Bill 137, regarding a minimum wage for tipped employees?
Yes.
How is that going to work?
So right now, Eric, our minimum wage for tipped employees is 45% of the federal minimum wage. So 45% of 725, and that is $3.27 an hour. So in most states, they set a tipped minimum wage, okay? And it's not tied to the federal minimum wage. So by virtue of the fact that ours is, there's a big concern that if the federal minimum wage were to increase dramatically, and while it hasn't happened yet, people are, especially in the hospitality industry, that's been, you know, so hard hit that, you know, doubling the tipped wage, which is what it would be, almost to $7 an hour, would be cost prohibitive to restaurants and anybody in the hospitality industry. So what we're proposing to do is decouple the tipped wage from the federal minimum wage, and then if the federal minimum wage goes up, our tipped wage would, you know, would stay where it is, and if there'd be no change to, you know, New Hampshire law if the federal minimum wage stays the same. So I think, you know, in virtually all circumstances for tipped employees, the vast, vast majority of their salary is determined by their tips, not the tipped wage. And there's a real concern also among the employees that, you know, if you dramatically increase the cost to the restaurant, for instance, of the tipped wage and double it, that more and more facilities, especially some of your chains and things like that, are going to just go to ordering tablets, and there'll be fewer wait staff. And that, you know, this is a byproduct of increasing, you know, the minimum wage or just rising wage levels anyway. I mean, when you go into a supermarket now, most supermarkets have, you know, some kind of automated checkout system. Well, that's pretty obvious why. Because, you know, you plug a computer in, people run the barcodes, and there are fewer employees in the store. And so technology is replacing human labor as the cost of labor goes up. And so that's always been one of the reasons why I'm reluctant to support an increase in the minimum wage. Is it well-intended? Absolutely. But does it have adverse consequences to especially first-time job seekers that get priced out of the job market? It absolutely does. You increase the minimum wage, and you have job loss. I mean, it always happens, and that's my concern.
Well, you could make an argument that the free market will take care of the minimum wage, because I don't know of anybody or any job that pays 7.25 here in New Hampshire.
No. I mean, I was just talking to a friend of mine this morning who said that at Dunkin' Donuts, they're paying $15 an hour and up just to start. So, you know, that's the market, and that's, you know, where it's at now. So, at any rate, is it well-intended? Yes. Will it help some people? Yes. But will it hurt others? And it will, because some people are going to lose jobs, or they're going to lose hours, or for first-time job seekers, they're just going to have a harder time getting that first job, which, I mean, that's critically important, you know, for a first-time job seeker, that first job.
Well, you could make an argument that if the market has already pushed the wages up to $12, $13, $14, $15 an hour, in essence, that's what a new minimum wage would look like, and so far the world hasn't ended.
And I agree with that also, but, you know, when you do that, business owners move to technology, and we've seen that. So whether it's the market driving wages up or whether it's, you know, the government setting a minimum wage. So, you know, again, well-intentioned, helps some people, but it definitely hurts others.
All right. Now, this is one that was kind of strange. I actually read the text of the bill, and I was a little confused by it. Senate Bill 51 about lobster meat sales. Evidently, you need a permit, unless you're already a retailer, to sell lobster or crab that needs refrigeration. Is this a food safety issue, or because it seems?
I think it's a bit of an overreach at this point, because it just, my understanding of the bill, dealt with frozen lobster. And if you had frozen lobster, why did you need to pay the couple of $100 for a permit?
Well, that's true. And it's funny you say that, because that was the first thing that went through my mind is, in a state that's practically obsessed with shrinking the size of government, that doesn't do it.
Well, this bill will obviate the need for the permit.
Right. But it's still more government, you know, interference, I think. If somebody wants to sell lobster, well, fine, sell lobster.
I think there is more of a public health concern for a live lobster. What we're trying to do is make it simpler for frozen. So, anyway.
All right, here's a stupid question. Who was Wentworth Cheswell? Do you happen to know?
No, I don't.
Okay, only because there's a bill coming up. And I don't know if that's, you know, he was involved. Was he with the original Governor Wentworth? I don't know. April 11th of 2022 is, according to House Bill 283, Wentworth Cheswell Day.
Oh yeah,
and it was moved over the Senate. Well, I forget the committee, but it was like, oh, I wonder who he was. I'll have to look him up.
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah,
well, that's one you got.
That's okay. All right. We are talking with Jeff Bradley, of course, a state senator from New Hampshire, representing Wolfboro and many other towns. Now, there's I've also heard about redistricting going on.
Every 10 years, the federal government does a census. When we get a census report, then it's obligatory that we draw all the, you know, districts, whether it's state rep, state senate, executive council, or congressional races, so that you best assure that every person's vote counts the same. So in other words, if you had a, you know, we have two congressional districts in New Hampshire, so they try, the guidelines are to band it so that just to make it simple, that, you know, we have 1.3 million people in New Hampshire. So let's say a million of them are of voting age. So ideally, you would want the first district to have 500,000 and the second district to have 500,000, so that everybody's vote counts roughly the same. If the second district was 1.5 million and the first district 500,000, those 500,000 would have a disproportionate effect on, you know, that member of Congress versus other members of Congress. So that's the goal. Now, it doesn't have to be 500,000 and 500,000, but a band within a, you know, a small percentage variable. And so then, you know, what you do is, if changes have to be made, you know, one town might move from one congressional district into another. And, you know, trying to balance that out so that, you know, you have that one person, one vote guideline is where the redistricting comes in. Now, obviously, you know, redistricting can be, you know, highly partisan. I think that, you know, we're going to, you know, when we get the census results, it'll be an open process. And my sense is that the, you know, congressional districts, Senate, executive council, aren't going to look that much different, you know, moving forward than they do today. But it's way too early to tell that, too, until we have the census.
Well, on the federal level, maybe you can help me understand the term gerrymandering. As I understand it, and tell me if I'm wrong, it's the designing of not necessarily logical districts to benefit one party or the other.
Yeah, and that happens. And sometimes both parties agree on that happening to make safe districts for, you know, certain members of Congress. It's generally more of a congressional district where there's greater flexibility because the numbers are so much bigger. The smaller the district, the harder, you know, that is to do. The courts have thrown out some so-called gerrymandered districts that look like salamanders, and I get that. I think that we've largely avoided those kind of situations in New Hampshire. We'll have another crack at it next year.
Well, it's hard to gerrymander two districts. I mean, not that it's not impossible, but, you have two districts. It's relatively simple, I would think.
It should be relatively simple. We'll see, we'll see what happens.
Should there be, even though I'm sure Congress doesn't have the will to pass it, should there be an end to gerrymandering and have them do it in a more fair way?
So, there's always the opportunity for anyone to file suit against the district, and then a court, gets to oversee how that's drawn, and sometimes courts have thrown out districts. There's been talk of, and I've supported it in the past, of an independent redistricting commission, but everybody who would be on an independent redistricting commission is also human, and would a district be, or, for instance, in the state of New Hampshire, 400 House districts and 24 Senate districts, 5 Council districts, and 2 Congressional districts be drawn better than, the way they've been drawn? I mean, some people would say yes, other people would say no. I think that, we're going to have an open process, and people are going to get the opportunity to, state their case on what the districts look like. And I think, when all is said and done, they're probably not going to change all that much, would be my guess. But I am just guessing at this point because I haven't seen the census data yet.
Yeah, I guess it's been held up for whatever reason. I'm not sure. But it's a government operation, so they'll release it when they're darn good and ready. 12:45, thank you very much for listening. I'm Eric Scott. This is Jeb Bradley, of course, state senator and Wolfboro resident, also New Hampshire Senate Majority Leader. There is one thing you can help me with. As I was looking through Legiscan, there are four milestones for a bill, and two of them I did not know. Maybe you can help us out. There's introduced, there's engrossed, enrolled, and passed. Well, the first and the fourth are self-explanatory. But what are engrossed bills and enrolled bills?
I'm assuming, because I've never heard that term engrossed, but I'm assuming what that means is they are up for consideration in both the Senate and the House. And so what happens if a bill comes in, let's say it's a Senate bill, and it's simply a policy bill. We had a bill this year that made changes to how people can do living wills. Has no financial implication, okay, to the state. So it just went through the policy committee. It was voted, ought to pass, and it's sent to the House. And the same thing likely will happen there, okay? Contrast that with my broadband bill, okay, that was the matching grant initiative. And even though I hadn't put any money into it at the time, we will, you know, when it, when the federal dollars are ready. But that went through first the policy committee, then it went to the finance committee in the Senate. And I presume that will be, you know, the same case in the House, that it will go to both the policy committee and the finance committee in the House. And then I based on what you said, I think that's the engrossing, the consideration, the public hearings, the voting. Enrolling is a somewhat arcane, you know, process. So what happens? A bill passes, and then the enrolling process is to make sure that there were no technical errors in the bill, that, you know, wrong citation or a grammatical mistake that nobody caught, or a misplaced comma or something like that. And so they're generally, when a bill goes through the enrolling process, most of them go through with no changes whatsoever. But occasionally, you know, something got missed technically. So it's possible to have what's called an enrolled bills amendment that becomes part of the, you know, record on the bill, and then obviously passage. Okay. And passage is when the governor signs it, or the legislature would override a governor's veto.
Should we be teaching this stuff in our schools? Because we're really not.
Teaching what stuff?
How state government works and how a bill gets through. I mean, my generation had Schoolhouse Rock at least. You know, it wasn't perfect, but it was better than nothing. But that's not even on TV anymore.
I absolutely think that we need to teach more civics, and not just in New Hampshire, but in this country. And I think that, you know, we just passed something that'll be on its way to the governor to require, you know, a basic level of civics to get a high school degree, and that means a test. And there was some opposition to that, but if you looked at, you know, what the test is, even somebody with a very basic level of civics is going to get the 70% threshold that you need to be able to pass that test, in my opinion. I mean, I didn't take the entire test. It's 125 questions. I probably did half of it, and I had one wrong answer, and the question was, when was the, you know, Constitution signed? And honestly, I probably should have known this better. I couldn't remember if it was 1787 or 1789. I chose 1789, and I was wrong.
Oh, that's what I would have chosen, too.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to remember that. 1787, then.
Oh, yep.
I didn't know that. Of course, you know, there's always the old joke that your kids give you, that history was easier back then because there was less of it. But, yeah, I used to run that line on my father, too. He always kind of enjoyed it. But how would that work? You said there was a bill kind of in process. Tell me, can you give me kind of the, you know, how that came about, and do you know who was involved in it and where it is now?
Which bill again was that, Eric?
The civics bill.
Oh, so it's passed the House, passed the Senate, it's on its way to the governor.
Oh, okay. So once the governor signs it, then it goes, I would assume, now that it's become a law, the Department of Education has to say, okay,
yes.
Here's,
and
what,
I think
here's what we're going to teach.
Postpone the implementation date for 2 years so that everybody would have an opportunity to adjust to it.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. Now, when you, the question I have next is, if we require a test on civics to graduate high school, why don't we use tests to graduate high school in other subjects?
Well, I would be open to that discussion, quite frankly. I think in Massachusetts, there's a matriculation test that ensures that people have, you know, some basic knowledge of the subject matter that schools teach. I don't have a problem with that philosophically. So, other people do. You know, there was a partisan debate on the civics bill and requiring the test. But, I think that it is a way of measuring, a student's aptitude. It's not, probably defining of the student and his or her ability to be able to learn. But I think it's pretty important. But
well, I would agree.
I think that'd be difficult to get it passed, though. But who knows? Maybe. So the civics exam is a first step in that regard.
And do you expect the governor to sign it? Knowing what I do, he will.
Yep, I think so.
Okay. And you said there's a 2-year delay. So they
I believe
get
that's
everything.
What it was. Yeah,
right.
June okay. 24th.
All right, so if you're a high school junior or a senior, you don't have to worry about it. But if you're younger than that, you better start boning up on your civics pretty soon. We're talking with Jeb Bradley, of course, state senator of Wolfboro. What was the other one? Oh, here it is. There was a House Bill 500. I don't know if you're familiar with this one, about food waste and child hunger. And the reason I mention it is my wife babysits. And as you know, they've been distributing, lunches with the children when they do remote learning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very strange because we'll have 3, sometimes 4 children, depending on which, which family member needs us for that length of time. And the stuff we get for the kids' lunch is random. It's weird. You'll get 4 lunches and 2 will have peanut butter and jelly, and 2 will have something else, or there'll be 3 white milks and 1 chocolate milk. It's just kind of weird. But what I don't think anyone has really celebrated the fact that school food always tastes great, because it was school food. You remember going to school? It was better than nothing, don't get me wrong, and I think it's a great program, but what can we do about this to, as long as we have these federal guidelines as to calories from fat and this, that, and the other thing, how do we balance what the kids need with what they want?
Yeah, that's a really good question, being the father of 4 kids and remembering, what it was like and trying to, at the time, I owned a natural food store and trying to get our kids to eat, natural foods when their friends were, eating something different wasn't always the easiest. Now, it's funny that as they've gotten older, their diets are pretty good. And, I think with a gentle persuasion, and not always being hardcore were pretty helpful. I think that, it's really difficult in, a school setting to, be too overbearing. And kids like pizza. I mean,
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know. I like pizza, too.
I don't think anybody doesn't like pizza, but you can't serve it 5 days a week either.
Well, some people would eat it 5 days a week.
Yeah, you're probably right. Actually, when I was in grade school, I probably would have eaten it 5 days
a
week.
And you know what? I don't think it's that unhealthy either.
Well, no, it's not, really, depending on what you put on it.
Yeah.
But I was just curious as to, I know there were some cities and towns across the country that have experimented with bringing in branded restaurants, like one of the most popular is Subway, because it's relatively healthy. Granted, deli meat is not the healthiest thing on the planet, but it beats the hell out of a Whopper.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wondered why they don't put those in airline gates either. You could pick up a sandwich, bring it on the plane with you.
Yeah.
I always wonder why they don't put those there.
I mean, I think Subway's done a pretty good job, quite frankly.
Yeah, I think they have.
Being quick and easy and healthy.
And relatively inexpensive. So would you be adverse to bringing in branded food operations? I know a lot of schools, especially colleges, outsource their operations, but not to
branded ones. No, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I think that in New Hampshire, those are decisions best left to the school.
Okay, that's not something the legislature would handle. That's the school would handle.
Well, it might be, but again, I think it's probably best left to the school.
I understand. Okay. Well, we are running out of time. It is coming up on 12:58 here on WASR. And once again, we are talking with Jeb Bradley. Beautiful day tomorrow. Rainy day on Sunday. So I hope you decide soon whether you're going to go hiking or work in your garden.
Either way, I'm going to be outside. You can depend on that.
And it looks like I'm going to be getting some motorcycle time tomorrow, which I'm looking forward to. So, but anyway, thank you very much, Senator. I do appreciate your time, and I hope you have a fantastic weekend.
All right. Take care. Thanks so much.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. Coming up on 12:59, thank you very much for listening. Don't forget, later this afternoon, Mike and the Hoss, a special two-hour edition, because on Tuesdays they're coaching basketball, baseball now, pardon me, baseball. So we've been doing the show from 4 to 6 on Friday for the next 4 or 5 weeks or so. So we could win some prizes, you know, have some fun. Mike and the Hoss, 4 o'clock here on WASR. 1 o'clock news is next.